stock market. And he said even in the off chance that they might want to, for instance, you know, build a factory to build something, there's no one out there to actually buy the goods that they would produce. So he said, you know, you're just throwing away tax dollars when you give, like, these Bush tax cuts to the wealthy during a recession. He says you got to stimulate the economy, which means increase in government spending rather than laying off the 600,000, 700,000 government employees that we've done since the Depression started. And it means if you're going to give a tax break, give a tax break to the working class, and it means giving a pay raise to the low and moderate income workers. And unfortunately, it seems like whether you're a Democrat like Governor Cuomo or, you know, Republican like Governor Scott out there in Wisconsin, you're going in the opposite direction. You're promoting an austerity budget. And I also was reading Paul Krugman, who more recently won the Nobel Prize for the economy. And one of the things he says, these austerity budgets, all they're going to produce is more austerity and more recession. The economy will further collapse, tax revenues will go down, spending will go down, more people will get laid off. He said, in a recession, this austerity budget approach is the absolutely wrong approach. And I kind of think these two guys who won the Nobel Prize for economics maybe know a little bit more than, say, Obama and Cuomo knows about what to do to put America back to work.
The legislative session ends tomorrow. They will be back in special session, I guess, after the election in November?
Well, there's no requirement that they come back, but traditionally they come back 1 or 2 days to do maybe a few things. Sometimes it's to correct some legislation they pass, but often in more recent years it's to try to pass things they sort of want to hide from the voters. We say if they want to do a pay raise, which I don't think is justified, but if they think it's justified, then they should have the courage to stand up before the voters and say, hey, city council members in New York City get $100,000. We as state legislators feel that we should get as much. And if people disagree with that, then they can vote them out of office or vote for somebody else. And also, I mean, part of the rationale, if you're a state legislator, for paying a higher wage for this part-time job, well, we need the money to attract qualified people. Well, if that's the case, shouldn't you tell people what the wage is before the election rather than after the election, because somebody might make a decision to run based on the higher salary? And that's why the people wrote into the Constitution that these guys' compensations is not supposed to be increased once they've been elected. And I think to the average person, once they've been elected means once the election is over with, not once they're sworn into office 2 months later.
Mark Dunley is Executive Director of the Hunger Action Network of New York State. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, June 20th, 2012. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding a meeting to discuss programming on Thursday, June 28th at 6 p.m. inside the Wall Street Atrium at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. That's Thursday, June 28th at 6 p.m. inside the Wall Street Atrium at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. All or invited.
And you are tuned to Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And tonight we have a very special program for you on the upcoming program called Earthwatch, in which we have what, as far as we know, is the first conversation with the attorney in the United States for the beleaguered editor of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. For those of you who do not know, overnight, Julian Assange sought asylum in the embassy of Ecuador. Pardon the back talk, because we're having open door policy because of air conditioning issues and such. But in any case, Julian Assange sought refuge in the embassy of Ecuador after escaping house arrest. And earlier today on our other program called 5 o'clock Shadow, your host of Earthwatch tonight was the person whom we believe to be the first to actually get a definitive statement from the attorney of Julian Assange, in the person of Michael Ratner. And we're going to hear some of that tonight, so please stay tuned. This is Earthwatch on WBAI.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. The beating sound of the hammer for justice that comes. When the will the world stop and listen, when will we all stop and see? Cause he looks upon us with a frown, to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. Innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? When sing that the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine, light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
And this is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. And we have some special content for you tonight, because earlier today on a different program called 5 o'clock Shadow, an investigative news magazine, we had the opportunity to be the first, as far as we know, within all of Pacifica and perhaps the other media, to have an in-depth conversation with the attorney for WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange. Anybody who's about liberation of information knows that WikiLeaks is that which brought us the collateral murder video of the helicopter assassination by the United States in Iraq, in Baghdad, of two Reuters journalists. Not to mention 500,000 secret cables, the last one we'll know with any candidness from the United States State Department. Not to mention the treasure trove of the privateered intelligence agency called Stratfor, which indicated that there was a secret indictment against Julian Assange in the United States, which gives more valence to the claims that his potential extradition to Sweden could mean his ultimate captivation in Guantanamo in the United States under the great liberal behavior of the administration of President Barack Obama. So let us now take a moment to consider the evidence. And this is, as far as we know, the first definitive statement from the American attorney of Julian Assange in the person of the great Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who spoke with us exclusively earlier today on the program 5 o'clock Shadow about the state and fate about the state and fate of Julian Assange following his surprising appearance at the Embassy of Ecuador in London, despite his house arrest, whereupon he appealed for international salvation, refugee status. It is a breaking story whose details are incompletely detailed in conventional media. But this is part of what we do here at Pacifica Radio. So here now, we begin tonight's edition of Earthwatch with a recollection of our fortunate encounter and expose of the issues of this case of information liberator Julian Assange in our conversation just a few hours ago with Michael Ratner. This is Earthwatch on WBAI.
Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and people around the world woke up today to the surprise announcement that the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, who had been under house arrest in England, was now at the Ecuadorian embassy to the United Kingdom, where he is seeking asylum because he fears for the conditions he will face if he is extradited to Sweden and then probably to the United States. To help clarify these breaking developments, we're happy to be joined by Julian Assange's American lawyer, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome back, Michael.
Robert Knight, it's always good to be with you. You've been doing a great job as usual. I was surprised, as you were, when I got a note or a text from someone saying, Julian Assange is just going into the Ecuadorian embassy and is asking for political asylum. And so I'm trying to figure out how to sort it out. And, of course, I have a good understanding of it, and I think you actually summarized it pretty well. I mean, broadly stated, what was going to happen to him is he'd lost all his appeals against going to Sweden through the English courts. And that's the case in Sweden around Julian Assange is the allegations, there's no charges yet, the allegations that Julian Assange was involved in sexual abuse of two women. And he was wanted for questioning in Sweden, not yet, if at all, for a criminal charge. And he was in England at the time that they'd been requesting him from Sweden. And he resisted that, going to Sweden, not because I think it was to him the key issue of whether he went to Sweden and answered questions. That could have resulted in a few different results. It could have resulted in no charges. It could have resulted in charges. It could have resulted in a trial. But I don't think that was that's never been his biggest worry. His biggest worry is if and when he went to Sweden, would it be easier for the United States to get its hands on him? We can talk about why the United States wants to get its hands on him. But when I heard about it, I said, well, he had really two bad choices, one worse than the other. The worst choice that would have happened is on July 7th, which is, I think, roughly the day he was going to have to be taken to Sweden in custody. He would have gone into Sweden. They would have put him in prison. They have no bail in Sweden at all for this. It wasn't charges, but even for this kind of allegation. And he would have been more or less incommunicado in Sweden. And then even assuming Sweden decided not to charge him with any kind of sexual abuse crime, at that moment, he wouldn't have been released, it's likely, because the United States would have been right there in the courtroom saying, here we are, it's an extradition warrant, and he would remain in jail. And then ultimately, assuming he would not beat that extradition warrant in Sweden, because Sweden is pretty familiar, really goes along with what the United States wants, ultimately, he would have wound up in a prison in the United States where he was facing conditions and a trial that we can talk about. So he had that was one of his choices, let himself broadly get into the hands of the United States ultimately, or the other one, get himself into an embassy and ask for political asylum. And considering the consequences of what he was facing, if the United States ever gets his hands on him, where politicians have even called for him to be murdered, that was a really bad choice had he had to go that way. Not that it's an easy choice to go into the Ecuadorian embassy, because who knows what the outcome is, and again, you and I can talk about that.
Michael Ratner, you certainly have been doing wonderful work with the center and your colleagues on the issue of people who are brought for detention into the United States. And this may not be unrelated to the potential fate of Julian Assange as the editor of WikiLeaks, which published, of course, the video collateral murder about the civilians killed by American troops in Iraq, as well as the treasure trove of the State Department secret cables. But the latest publication of WikiLeaks was from the for-hire intelligence agency known as Stratfor, in which the leader of that group said that he had inside information that there is a sealed indictment for Julian Assange. What is your estimate of the truth of that claim, and what could he be facing here?
You know, a lot of the discussion is, well, you don't know there's an indictment, Michael Ratner. You don't know there's an indictment, Julian Assange. So, you know, why aren't you going to Sweden? You don't know that. To me, the first thing is, if there's no indictment, and if there's no potential prosecution, or if there's no targeting of Julian Assange by the United States, then if the United States says that, and while I haven't spoken to Julian about this, but if the United States says that he's under no risk of being extradited to the United States and facing charges for what we're going to discuss next, espionage, then I think Julian Assange would go to Sweden. because then he can deal with that case, and none of us know, you know, the truth or the non-truth of that case, but he can deal with that case in Sweden, and he would. I just think the underlying issue is, once he's in Sweden, he might as well say he's in the United States. So the Stratfor email that you're referring to is the one that says there's a sealed indictment against Julian Assange, and Stratfor, of course, is a private intelligence agency. You know, how reliable? I mean, you know, it is a private intelligence agency. It has close access to people in the CIA and otherwise. So it may well be reliable. I add that to other facts that I know when I make my estimate that it's very likely there's an indictment or a potential indictment of Julian Assange. I add to that that there's an ongoing grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia, you know, one of the more conservative courts. It's been investigating WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning, of course, the private who allegedly leaked the documents to WikiLeaks. Bradley Manning, who is currently on trial, or currently going through the proceedings of various phases of a court martial at Fort Meade. And that grand jury was looking into both Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And there's been witnesses called before that grand jury. So the speculation, that's not speculation, the Stratfor claim that there's a sealed indictment against Julian has foundation. And we've also sent people and gone to various phases of the Bradley Manning trial. And at that trial, it has come out that from FBI agents that they're investigating various civilians. Bradley Manning, of course, was in the military. Various civilians who are founders and or work at WikiLeaks. So we're talking about, you know, you put that together with you know, all these politicians and everybody else calling for prosecution of Julian Assange, and you're saying he's taking a high risk in going to Sweden, is what I would say. And you ask me, Robert, well, what are the charges? Well, you know, Bradley Manning is being charged under military law with all kinds of computer hacking kinds of stuff, and with aiding the enemy, which is, you know, somewhat equivalent to espionage. We have a U.S. espionage statute that has never really been used against journalists or publishers. But on the other hand, they are looking at it, at this grand jury, and looking at it with regard to Julian Assange. And we have to put it in the context of the Obama administration having prosecuted six whistleblowers already, which is double the number of whistleblowers prosecuted in all prior administrations, which total three. So they're looking heavily, obviously, at Julian Assange. I think, as I said, that there's most likely an indictment of him already. Espionage carries a life sentence, potentially. One section of it actually carries a death penalty. We would hope Europe doesn't. We'd hope Europe wouldn't extradite to a death penalty. They'd have to get an assurance that there isn't before they extradite here, because Europe doesn't agree with the death penalty. But he could technically be facing the death penalty and certainly life in prison. And the conditions, which is where you began the questions, you know, the conditions he'd be held under, we're familiar with because of everybody from our clients at Guantanamo to Pelican Bay, to U.S. Federal prisons, the Florence ADX, to what they do with people like Julian Assange. And I can only tell you, the chances are, they're 100% or not, but they're close to saying he would be put in solitary for a very long time. He would have no communication with the outside world at all, other than people like me or attorneys going to visit him. We would not be able to get on a radio show like yours, Robert, and say, I spoke to Julian Assange and here's what he told me, because the government would claim he has like all this computer stuff in his head and it might be secret codes. And so he would be isolated and cut off. He would then be tried for most likely for an espionage charge, maybe conspiracy to commit espionage, conceivably with Bradley Manning. And he could be put away for a very long time in the context of a country that has gone after him heavily on this. And politicians that want his, that want him executed or to serve life in prison. And this is in the context for me of someone who is a real hero, who has disclosed the collateral murder video concerning the two Reuters journalists who were killed by U.S. Army, including the attacks on children in Iraq. He He disclosed the Iraq war documents, which disclosed that 15,000 people, more civilians, were murdered than the U.S. had said. The Afghan war logs, which again talk about many killings that were unacknowledged before then. And then, of course, the thing that brought the ire up to very high level was the WikiLeaks State Department cables, 100,000 or more cables, that brought out all kinds of hypocrisy in our State Department. So when someone is a whistleblower, or really in that case a publisher, and a journalist like that, that brings out all of that material, they should be treated as heroes because they're lifting the veil of secrecy that so now covers up all the misdeeds of our government and so undercuts democracy, which is based on knowing what our government does. So he should be a hero, and the people who committed the war crimes, as you and I have discussed before, people like Rumsfeld and others, they should be in the dock and not Julian Assange. So unfortunately, it's utterly reversed in this country. The journalists haven't really gone out and supported Julian Assange, which they should, and supported WikiLeaks. I find it to be terrible. I find his personal and political situation to be just awful right now. The two choices he had, as I started this show with you, were crazy, because one was putting himself in the hands of the United States, and the other is putting himself in the hands of the Ecuadorian embassy, which may not be so bad inside the embassy, but even assuming they give him political asylum, how does he get out of the embassy?
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we're speaking live with the attorney in the United States for Julian Assange, Michael Ratner, who is also a co-host of the program Law and Disorder Heard Monday mornings on these airwaves. And Michael, I am so grateful for your taking time out in what must be a very stressful and busy day given these breaking events. And my final question for you is this. Julian Assange is, again, overnight in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he has sought asylum because of political persecution and the attempt to extradite him to Sweden and then the United States. Now, if I am not mistaken, his being there is a violation of the terms of the bail that was set for him. And short of a transporter beam, if he is indeed granted asylum in Ecuador, as hinted at by President Correa some time ago, short of a transporter beam, I don't see how he could get there without being arrested and then remanded to Sweden and possibly the United States, unless he were granted Ecuadorian citizenship and then appointed a diplomat and thereby have immunity.
That's one I hadn't thought of.
Robert, I'm glad to help.
Should be part of our legal team. Anyway, interesting. Very interesting. I hadn't thought of that one, but that's pretty interesting. But you're right. The problem is, even if he gets political asylum, and I'm optimistic, then how does he get out of the embassy? Because when he leaves the embassy, he's no longer protected by the Vienna Convention, which protects the embassy and considers it essentially part of Ecuador for purposes of any other country going into it. When he steps out onto British UK land outside of the embassy, he can be arrested, and there's cops sitting there right as we speak saying, we're going to arrest him. So at that point, he either needs a safe passage from the UK, which seems at this point unlikely. Of course, we never know in these situations. Or your thought of giving him citizenship, perhaps that would work. Or, you know, we thought, you know, he could go into a embassy car with one of those little flags you see all the time and then drive to the airport and then run into the airplane. Well, that's probably not so great because the Vienna Convention, we don't know, doesn't really necessarily can have the same efficacy with regard to a car, and, you know, has to get out on the tarmac and all that. So the two proposals on now we have in front of us are yours, which is interesting to say the least, and the other one, and I think yours may be more likely than getting him a safe conduct, but you never know. You know, there's a history to this kind of stuff. If you look through the pages, particularly during the Cold War, when people who opposed various, you know, various governments, particularly in the Soviet Union or allied countries, one in Hungary in particular, Cardinal Maczynski, whatever people thought of Cardinal Maczynski, he went into a U.S. embassy in Hungary and stayed there for 14 or 15 years, lived in the embassy, and finally Hungary gave him a safe passage out of the country. So these things are, you don't know how it's going to come out. And I think that's, it's going to make an interesting story. But, you know, the thing you know is, we know how it would have come out had he gone to Sweden. And I don't mean about the Sweden abuse charges, because those, I, you know, serious as they might be, and none of us know, because there hasn't been a trial yet, and you have to presume him innocent until there's a trial. But serious as those might or might not be, they just pale in comparison to what would have happened to him if the United States gets its hands on him, both in the conditions of his confinement, which if you look at Bradley Manning, who was tortured while he was in confinement, and in what would have happened to him at trial. So he made, of the bad choices he had, he probably made the one that made the most sense for himself.
Well, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights and of Law and Disorder, I thank you so much today for so well representing, both on 5 O'Clock Shadow and in the courts, your client, Julian Assange.
Robert Knight, it's always good to talk to you, and pleased you're still with us at WBAI.
All right. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. More after this.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
And this is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. My name is Robert Knight, and earlier today we had what we believe to be the first exclusive live interview with the American attorney of WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange, about the startling developments overnight of his seeking of asylum in the embassy of the nation of Ecuador, where sometime earlier President Correa had stated that he would be welcome to live in peace there. Julian Assange is
In a very odd and discriminatory position, because there is no indictment against him over sexual allegations made by two women in Sweden. So the merits of the extradition are questionable. And the Swedish authorities say that they merely want to question him, but they could have done that by simply coming to England, where he was under house arrest, without the necessary condition of his being extradited from the United Kingdom to Sweden, where early on in this complex controversy, our guest that you just heard, the great attorney, Michael Ratner, tweeted upon his surprise awareness of the breaking events just a short time ago, prior to our interview on 5 o'clock shadow. According to WikiLeaks Central, Julian Assange's U.S.-based lawyer Michael Ratner commented on the request via Twitter. And before we interviewed Michael Ratner, our friend and esteemed colleague, who thinks I ought to be on the legal team because I thought of how to get him out diplomatically. But nevertheless, Michael Ratner, initially upon the surprise of the world about this situation, tweeted the following. Julian's asylum, not about questioning in Sweden. Stop. Facing life in solitary in U.S. with no com, C-O-M-M, period, for exposing war crimes? Period. What would you do? Query, query, query. Sweden easier. Smaller. Lawyers in United Kingdom, remarkable. More public support. He, Assange, would be in jail in Sweden. U.S. lodges warrant, and he never is out. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks to the generosity of Julian Assange's American lawyer, Michael Ratner, and the tradition that you have supported here on WBAI for truth, revelation, and justice in regard to the secret operations of the government for which you pay. This is a seminal moment. I don't think anyone else has had such an inside legal opinion or statement than you have made possible with 5 o'clock shadow, and here we reiterate it tonight on Earthwatch. So thank you all very much for every moment of support that you've given to WBAI, because we are in a war of information, and you are on our side. I would have said we're on your side, but that's patronizing or matronizing. We're going to take some phone calls, because this is fast-breaking news. I'll try and get updates as the program continues. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. Also do 5 o'clock shadow, the investigative news magazine. And the phone number here is 212-209-2900. And this here is Earthwatch. And we get to talk about things in a less formal way tonight. And you're on the air. Hello. Are you there? Hello? This is Earthwatch. We'll take the next call. You're on the air.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Robert?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Bob Fass.
Bob, I so much wanted to talk to you tonight. Oh,
just
thank you.
Let me turn my radio down.
Who gets to tell Bob Fass to turn his damn radio down? Oh, I feel so good. Thank you, Bob.
I was listening this afternoon to you when you were on with Michael Ratner. And I felt like such a shiver go down my back, such a like a feeling of apprehension. And then I remembered that even though Michael Ratner had been talking about how if Julian Assange, he did represent Julian Assange, he wouldn't be allowed to report on the trial. He wouldn't be allowed to tell anyone outside of the military tribunal that would try him what was actually going on in the trial. And then I was relieved when the station went off the air for about 5 minutes to remember that WBAI has such inept engineers and such inept engineering that, well, you know, it could be just, you know, a question of the money not being there to pay for repairing the equipment or whatever it was. But it was a chilling moment, Robert, when you went off after Ratner said that. And I got a call tonight.
Bob, I did not know that.
That you went off the air?
You mean the terrestrial FM signal discontinuated?
Well, you might say it that way if you wanted to use words of six syllables when words of two syllables would do.
They shut us down?
We were shut down for, at least 5 minutes, at least in this area.
At what point of the interview? No, I did not know that, Bob.
I was listening on FM, and maybe the online signal was going out over FM for a while. At any rate, what's happening to Julian Assange is such a clearly put-up job, you know. When they go into the bedroom, you can almost always be sure that they're...
Bed bugs.
What?
Bed bugs.
What's that?
Bed bugs.
Well, whatever the reason, Julian Assange did us all a favor. He's right there with John Peter Zenger and Daniel Ellsberg.
Yes, sir.
And I hope you... I hope you can get some of your listeners to hear about Stanley Cohen, who's representing a lot of the people who were arrested downtown. He represented some squatters very successfully, and he's being charged with some kind of technical tax evasion in Syracuse, New York. He's probably going to be indicted. They're attacking the lawyers. They did that in Chile before they came after the population.
They did that in Chicago.
Yep.
Bob, I am so honored
Robert.
To hear your voice, and you are a Peter Zenger in an even more creative way as a progenitor of what we know today as freeform radio. And that you
Robert,
listen to me today
Robert,
is my honor.
When people say you're the father of freeform radio, I wish I'd worn a condom.
Well, you know what it is? It's a paternity suit.
Robert, keep it up.
Don't you dare go away, Bob Fass. This is Earthwatch, and I got you right now. Because I tried to call you earlier, you know. Because of the great moment coming up within a week from today, in which there is the New York premiere of the documentary film about the publishable part of your body of work, of Radio Unnameable. Tell us about that.
Well, Robert, the hero of the film is really the cabal, the listeners. You can see so many of their faces in some of the crowd scenes. It's not really so much about me as about what I've been, the Bob at the gate, as the Sufis say.
You were just there when it happened, huh?
I was just not holding the door open. You know, we're holding it closed.
Well, how can you see a cabal on film?
Well, for instance, when there was an action where we cleaned a street on the Lower East Side, there were photographers who were there and captured all of the faces, all of the the kids who joined in to clean a whole street from one river to the other. We had announced that we would clean one street, and the Department of Sanitation was very busy. They had cleaned that street for the first time in 10 years the night before we were scheduled to arrive. But we looked around, we saw some other streets on either side of them, and we cleaned there instead.
You have such a subtle genius. I mean, here you are honoring me with the call to Earth Watch.
Robert,
you are my
Robert,
hero.
De-escalate your language a bit, will you?
All right, you suck. Okay, how about that?
It makes me feel like you're...
Bob, the first time I was ever on WBAI air was as an idiot when you had a musician on, and I called up all intimidated and proud. And you, my, you know, sharing that moment is only a microcosm of
who's the musician?
The Uncle Tom game. It was a long time ago. It'll come to me. But number one got down. Number seven was Uncle Tom. You know that song? It was a long time ago. See? And you innervated me to not fear that place that gave me the comfort you shared with me. And here we are today. And, Bob, it's not just my personal embiggenment that you made possible, but it is also that while I'm here as a catalyst in a moment of international political intrigue and revelation, you yourself held a seminal role in that in another early moment that was very formative in my politics. When you were the man who put up the up-against-the-wall Emmer Effers during the great retrenchment against the Stonewall people.
I was disappointed. I didn't like that when it happened. I thought that was going too far, but I did have to laugh.
Yeah, well, you were brilliant.
Like a lot of funny things, it ended in tears and blood. There was a group. It's after 10 o'clock. We can say their name, can't we? The Up Against the Wall Mother.
Mm-hmm.
I guess everybody can think
curse.
Of the other
yes.
word. It sounds like Off the Hook.
It was a moment. And here's what I'm...
Anyway,
wait, Bob, I got to say this.
Party.
Bob, wait. I got to say this about contemporary moments in politics. I just finished doing national reportage on the silent marches of 2012. Oh, you heard. And 1917, which were transformed because of the inclusion of the current march of the lesbian, gay, transgender... bisexual community, which was not an easy sell. And you were on that case back in the days of Stonewall. You are awesome, brother.
Well, the first silent, I mean, I don't know whether it was the first or not, but the first silent march I ever heard of was the one after the Triangle Shirt Waist Fire, where because the guy who was running the Macaladora in the garment district locked young women in so they wouldn't take, you know, go out on the fire escape to get a breath of fresh air or leave too early. And when the fire struck, it was like that apartment building in Jackson Heights where the I think it was Jackson Heights, where the landlord took down all the fire escapes and thereby threw all of his tenants out into the street. You remember that little incident?
Oh, yeah. I heard about shirt waste. I know about that.
Ought to have been some kind of a demonstration then, but I think the Triangle Shirt Waste was a silent march. They were probably... silent marches, maybe with drum rolls going back in history. It really brings home the fact that the people who run things don't give a damn about what happens to the 1%, to the 99% rather. So there's been a lot of blood on the American stage, and I still feel that nonviolence is the only way to combat that. But people who run things should be aware that there are people who are not of my frame of mind, and who are being pushed to just too far.
The ones who should be kept away from the babies at the picnic.
What's that?
The ones who should be kept away from the babies at the picnic. The dangerous ones. The insecure ones, the violent ones.
Well, keep it up, Robert.
I'm going to keep you up. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, broadcasting on the terrestrial band at 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at WBAI.org.
I'm sure there are other callers, Robert. Why don't you put some of them on the air?
We're going to get to that, Bob. You ain't done yet. Because I have always, in the creation of my art, admired your improvisationalness. I mean, and you ain't even black.
Well, Robert, maybe on the outside I'm not.
but inside your heart is black, right?
But, you know, it's not really so long ago that we were all Africans, you know. I think skin is a marker, but it's not an irreplaceable marker of a person's heart.
Yeah, it's what Martin was saying, content of character, color of skin. Bob, it is so rare for anyone at WBAI to be consciously heralded as opposed to being subliminally channeled in future consciousness. And you have well beyond deservedly reached that level.
I have to interrupt you right there. See, because I can remember a time when the media, the external media, paid a lot of attention to what was on WBAI, a lot of attention. And the main reason that some of our better programs aren't reported more frequently in the news is because, it could be that we're not reaching out and telling them about it, and it could also be that they're freezing us out. But they know what we're doing. People in newspapers listen to WBAI.
In fact, we inform many of the stories they later report.
Quite true. Quite true.
Well, Bob, your incompleted body of work is being documented, at least in some part, by a fine new film that's going to be at the BAM Festival coming up within a week. And the film is itself like your show, which is heard 24 hours from now, called Radio Unnameable. And Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson and other people have put together an hour and a half. And I don't know how in hell they could have distilled all the crazy stuff you did. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, 50 years in 87 minutes is almost sounds like a joke, doesn't it? There is an awful lot of stuff, really important stuff, that I think the they just didn't find there was a space for it in the movie. But they certainly hit the high points, and I'm very happy with what they did. I'm thrilled, really, and it's so far it has been at the Full Frame Festival in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina,
down in my home country.
Sold out both two shows. It was in Sarasota Film Festival, also sold out and won a jury prize. And this next week, it's going to be at the Silver Dock Festival in Silver Springs, Maryland. That's
near
Washington, D.C.
Bob, as a investigator of the CIA, I think it's Silver Spring with no S.
What's that?
Silver Spring, no S, Maryland. I used to work for Computer Sciences Corporation. I think it's Silver Spring, not Silver Springs.
Could very well be. Could be.
But it's not that far from Langley and Alexandria County, but I'm just saying.
Well, could be. There are also some fine music schools in the area and some very good law schools. And I have an insight about the CIA that I think I got from Daniel Ellsberg. He said that, like any other big bird, it has a left and a right wing, and it can't fly without both, they think.
Brilliant.
So there are... We have friends in the strangest places, you know.
Tell us about the strange observance. I mean, among more than fans, you kind of broke a lot of barriers, brother. Be they sexual, racial, political, broadcast, communicative. What was your most paranoid moment?
My most paranoid moment? I don't know. It was probably when Utrice and her minions were kicking you around.
Good answer.
I remember that. I remember sitting at home and listening and knowing that this maniac was kicking you. I wonder if you remember it.
I didn't much notice.
Poor fellow is dead now. But he was about as far out as a person can be and still managed to show up on time and do a morning show. Well, maybe not as far out.
You make me laugh. You know, that which does not kill you.
What's that?
That which does not kill you merely bleeps you off. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and that is our friend, I'm proud to say, and legend, Bob Fass. And I want to see all of us on the 26th of June at BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, the last place of culture after the invasion of the sports games, with a guy who's named after a subway line. You know who I mean?
No.
Jay-Z. Yeah, subway line, Jay-Z. But no, seriously, the film is called Radio Unnameable.
Documentary.
It is a documentary. How can you put the universe in a ball jar? Well, that's
in
a ball jar. That's a southern thing about preserves, you know. You know, with the two-part lid, you know, flat part, and then you screw it on.
Right.
How can you contain lightning in a bottle? And the film by Paul Lovelace and Jessica Watson.
Wilson. Paul Lovelace. If you corrected my ass, I'll correct yours.
Well, bleep you. And thank you. By the way, by bleep, I mean thank.
What's that?
When I say bleep you, I mean thank.
Well, thank you very, very much.
So the film is about the radio legend and New York treasure, Bob Fass. It's a 87-minute film.
It's about the best audience in the world, the WBAI audience. Long may they listen to our waves.
Well, you'll hate. I'm going to continue reading this, Bob, because I can do that even if you aver. The father of freeform radio has been the host of Radio Unnameable on New York's WBAI for almost 50 years. Directors Lovelace and Wolfson of the Iowa Mixtape and the BAM Cinema Fest of 2 years ago make incredible. And Bob, I object to that word because I never want to give incredible reports. You know what I'm saying? I want people to believe it. But anyway, it says here, make incredible use of Fass's personal archives, a priceless trove of first-person political reportage, early interviews with 60s icons Bob Dylan, Abby Hoffman, and other far out, well, here I differ, ephemera, to craft this unforgettable documentary. Bob, you know, when I was, when I found myself in times of trouble, when I found myself in times of trouble, Brother Bob came to me and said, let's talk to Bob Dylan. And I said, let it be. Remember that? It was a great moment in my life.
Well, you were right. You were with the last time we spoke to Bob Dylan on the air. You asked him the question that made him say, well, I got to go.
Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, you said, what exactly did you mean by everybody must get stoned?
I can't believe I did that. To Mr. Dylan.
And he said, well, I got to go.
Yeah, yeah. A good answer, actually. It's just as enigmatic as his entire body of work. It was a beautiful reply, actually,
well,
if you think about it poetically.
He stopped the recording session to talk to us. That was really kind of him.
Yeah.
And Steve Benisrael was with us.
I was about to say that. Our lost brother, Steve Benisrael. Well, he wasn't lost. He found us. Bob, I know I spoke about him a week or two ago, but I give you this moment for our mutual friend, but your better knowledge friend, Steve Benisrael.
Well, I should be really happy now because of the movie, and so often, more often than I like, even I see or hear or think of something that reminds me of him. My eyes begin to burn, and I think of how many moments he was on the air with us at BAI when he escaped from Brazil and. He helped to organize a letter campaign to free the other members of the Living Theater who were being shown the instruments of torture in Brazil. Sam Melville letters from Attica, I don't know, with... you ever heard that piece he did with Frederick Shevsky, the great
composer of The People United Shall Never Be Defeated. Frederick Shevsky wrote a piece called Attica, based on the letters of Sam Melville. Sam Melville was somebody who was part of a group of underground warriors who blew up the draft board downtown in Manhattan without injuring anybody. Steve did a piece based on those letters that is chilling, as you can hear the boredom and the incessant brutality and the experimental chemistry and terrible food prison, and how he keeps trying to hold himself together. I think that was the name of the piece. I remember when he said, you know, you heard of, I'm sure you've been following the rent guidelines board. Steve said, of all of the animals in the world, the human being is the only one that pays rent. And other insightful and wonderful things. Remember when, I know you've seen him perform, but you remember when he says to the audience, what happened to all those people who were standing up and shouting, we won't take it anymore, in the 60s? He says, they're sitting in your seats.
He was brilliant.
And he said, you know, if not now, when? Well, get busy. Or words to that effect.
Bob, in your love of Steve Ben Israel, you humbly omitted to confess that you were contemporaries in Judith Malina's Living Theater.
No, we were not.
Not contemporaries, but you were both there.
Living Theater at the same time, but we were never in the same company, except at Three. We were in the same company at Threepenny Opera.
But, well, what made you all so bleeping weird about that experience at the Living Theater?
So weird. How do you mean that?
By that I mean populist, but conventionally characterized there as.
Judith comes from, you know, a tradition that encompasses wonder rabbis and German existential playwrights and. She and Julian Beck formed this non-violent group of artists called the Living Theater. I came from, I guess, more like a neighborhood playhouse actor's studio branch of theater, and some of the acting styles were quite different, but I thought she was a wonderful, wonderful theatrical artist, and in a lot of ways more talented than her great husband, Julian.
Bob, did you know that both she and I shared an award from the Humanist Society, the Church of Humanism?
I wouldn't be surprised to hear that.
I
wouldn't put it past you.
I don't know what I did, but I was some years ago, Reverend Joseph Ben David, a colleague of Hannah Arendt. Another liberator, as you well know, Bob.
Yeah.
And
I should tell you something else.
Yeah.
That might be settling to you.
Sorry, that's all the time we have tonight.
Go ahead.
Say what?
Chris Albertson is in the movie.
Yeah, well. No comment. Obsession is its own obsession. I'll leave it at that, okay?
Robert, I have an opinion about Chris Albertson that's based on knowing how for years he seethed with resentment at the bad way that Pacifica treated him. And it's unfortunate that you're the recipient of the venom that he's stored up. He doesn't even know that he's venomous, you know. I'm sorry, but please don't take it any more personally than you take the chanter or poor Monroe or Lynn Samuels, for that matter.
Lynn Samuels was my friend, and she understood the station. She understood who the affiliates were. She knew what WPFW was, and I consider her a great, beloved, late friend of mine.
Well,
And she never worked for U.S. military intelligence.
She what?
Lynn Samuels, as far as I know, never worked for U.S. military intelligence. She never worked for U.S. military intel.
As military intelligence,
and was able to somehow violate the precedent of no non-American nationals being employed by U.S. Armed Forces Radio, like the person you mentioned.
Oh! You say that Chris.
I am Batman. I've studied this.
Uh-huh. Well, that may very well be that all may well
leading
be true.
To his later entry into the United States.
That all may very well be true. I just know that.
And someone who never actually had to develop a budget of the magnitude we face here today at WBAI, because the rent was paid by the progenitor of BAI. So. At the time that someone claims to have been a great manager, there was not a great challenge comparable to that which we face today, that by some people is attempting to be undermined.
Well, I think...
By some people. I think some nostalgic people.
I wonder if you'll allow me to respond.
Of course, Bob.
That we certainly do have a larger... budget, and our audience is in worse shape economically than it was. For instance, there are not that many people who are, say, working at night and listening to the radio. A lot of those nighttime jobs have moved to places where people were making a living by picking up the garbage that they were forced to live in. You know, the dubious pleasure of alienated work has been spread around the world since we were on the air then. But Chris, when he was the manager. He was doing his best to keep the station afloat in whatever way.
Yes, at which time he had only to raise 15% of our current budget. 15%.
That's true, but it was in 60s dollars rather than in 21st century dollars. It's about a third.
I did not call for a boycott of WBAI when I was in exile.
What's that?
I did not call for a boycott of BAI. I supported the station when I was insecure.
But not everybody does that at such times.
Well, I did when I was. When it was
I know, and I admire you for that, Bob.
I was wrong. I did call for a boycott, and I was wrong. But
well, you know what unites you and me is that we love and support the station.
Please let me finish what I was saying. Chris is a very, very bad enemy. When he is angry, there is no reasoning with him. I had a conversation with him where I said, you know, we have this disagreement, Chris. When someone is beginning to do a job, or when you're teaching a child to swim, if the child, and I don't mean to say that you're a child, but you were doing two jobs at different times of the day, and you were trying to break a new audience in on a different kind of program, and sometimes I had a feeling that you, when you were trying to complete the last lap, your form wasn't so great. You were like the kid who is trying to swim. And what do you say when a kid who's trying to swim doesn't swim perfectly? You say, that was good. That was good. Next time it'll be even better. If you tell the kid that was terrible, next you're drowning yourself in this and the station. All you're doing is making an enemy, and you're not helping at all. I listen to your program sometimes with pleasure, and sometimes I think it's going to be better next time. My program is the same. Every time I go on the air that I try to do something that didn't work out, I have a feeling that I'm going to, have a chance to try again to do something a little bit better. And I have very little patience for people who say, that stinks, because it's not helpful. My acting teacher used to say, don't pay any attention to your critics, because even when they say you were wonderful, you were just wonderful, you'll know that there was something that you were doing that you could have done better.
Well, Bob, I believe that being involved with WBAI over the long period of history of one's octogenarian life, or however long we may have on this earth, means something better and higher than a suicide pact.
Than a what?
A suicide pact, a matter of mutual self-destruction in which one cannot accommodate the love, but only express the resentment.
Absolutely. 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 We have some tremendously talented people who worked at WBAI.
Of course.
Larry Josephson says some people leave, and some people leave angry, and some people leave very angry. And that's the history of this place. We are we're in the business of the continuing revolution. And
well, actually, that's placing us into history. When people think that the narcissism of a moment of imagined glory is that which requires the destruction of its subsequence.
Well, that's pointless. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, Bob.
Pointless and stupid.
QED, my point exactly in regards to things we were talking about before.
Robert, we ought to take a long walk on the beach sometime. There's a lot to talk about.
By the way, Chris Albertson hired you, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Hi.
Yes, he did. I mean, he didn't hire me the first time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was...
I'm not sure which one of us has been fired and rehired more times here at VA.
But I just wanted to put that on the record.
Well, you know, it's hard to... I don't know, it's hard for people like us to mesh with bureaucracies, I think. But
amen, brother. But I heard
BAI,
I heard that.
BAI is more tolerant of people like us than, say, Sirius or any other place where we could do what we do. And, you know, I'm happy to be associated even with some of the people that I've had, you know, terrible disagreements with over the years.
Bob, I am so honored to be associated with you. I think you are a genius of the galactic class in the form of Freeform Radio.
Oh, well, so are you, then. If I am, then so are you.
I'm merely a black hole.
No, I don't think so. I felt like that, though, once, as though a lot of things were swirling in toward me. But,
you know, you were the subject also of some fabulous novels in the Romain en Clef of some of your very exciting days. Do you remember that?
Let's see. There was Anita Hoffman's...
Exactly. I love that book.
Trashin, which was... It's a like a science fantasy about the Yippies.
It was a beautiful book. I loved it.
There's not really a lot of truth in it, but it's it was good mythology.
It'll do until the truth comes around.
But everybody has the right to think of themselves as, I don't know, like precious and unique, and. I listen to, you know, everybody on BAI, and there's always some spark of something that would make a fantastic, compelling and something that would inspire people to live like a kind of a more principled life, Chris Koch is going to be in this movie.
Oh, the guy who was censored under that administration, that person you mentioned.
Well, I think he sees it differently now.
Because he was reporting about the truth of the war in Vietnam and went there and repeatedly censored by Chris Albertson.
Well, Chris may have even known that he was there. The board of
I say this not just off the top of the head, but that's the actual testimony of Chris Koch.
Well, when did you talk to Chris last?
He published about it.
Many times, but I think in retrospect, he thinks that the two of them were kind of pointed at each other and said, let's you and him fight.
Well, you know, I see it a different way, Bob. Bob, excuse me. I see it a different way. There are some people who attack the conduct of U.S. wars abroad and who oppose the proponents of those wars domestically. And that is what I see in common with some things that I might have done and some things that Chris Koch might have done that received equal ire from some quarters.
Well, Chris didn't get... No one really complained about what Chris did. Even Albertson didn't complain about what Chris did.
That is not my reading of the record as stated by Chris Koch.
Well, I was there. I was there.
And so was Chris.
And by
that I mean so was Chris Koch.
Yeah. Robert, lots of times things happen at BAI where the people who are pulling the strings are outside the station. I'm sure you know that.
I know that, and there are people who oppose our opposition
to
war.
We were getting to be too popular, and we were too fresh, and we were smashing too many icons.
And then along comes Mary.
along comes somebody to criticize the impulse of criticizing the war, of criticizing the administration, of criticizing a president who is committing more war with more forgiveness than ever before.
Well, that's not what happened then, Chris. Chris Koch and Dale Miner did a fantastic series called This Little Light of Mine. And Chris Koch borrowed my tape recorder to go to North Vietnam.
And members
members of the board of directors were terrified that the State Department, who was prohibiting reporters other than the hand-picked reporter from the New York Times, whose reports weren't that optimistic about the war either, they were preventing electronic media from going there.
And when he came back, the station manager, who at that time was the person you mentioned, was censorious thereof, as was the progenitor, the donor to WBAI, who paid the rent for a manager who never had to face the challenges we do today.
Well, you have a story in you have the story all wrapped up with headlines, you know, and
where do you think I got the headlines, Bob?
I remember the nuances.
Where do you think I got the headlines, except for study?
From where?
Except from study, where do you think I got the headlines, which I'm required to say in brevity on the air?
Well, you know, I'm saying that your headlines are as, they're just the surface. And what was really going on at the station and in the board of directors was, It was the fear that pervaded the 50s coming out of the blacklists that led the board of directors and the people from the Center for Democratic Institutions, Halleck Hoffman and those others, from believing that BAI could get away with sending a reporter to North Vietnam. And then when they heard the reports and they compared them with the Agence France press reports, which were quite accurate as to what was going on, which Chris Albertson, procured for the station with,
and then censored when Chris Koch was reporting from his firsthand trip to Vietnam.
They didn't. They agreed completely that it was not a surprise to people who listened to BAI to know that the Viet Cong were popular with the people of South Vietnam, for instance. It was not news to the BAI audience, but the board of directors was afraid that this would get to the attention of the State Department, and actually, it was really hardly a blip. When we did a program with a defector from the FBI at that time, we also were terrified.
So management at the time engaged in self-censorship needlessly. So it was a needless self-censorship imposed by management.
Right. Well, Albertson, I guess, told me that he was thinking of resigning when that pressure was put on him to ask Koch for his reports prior to broadcast. Actually, they had
As a reporter broadcast. And a journalist, I find anathema.
Of course. Pre-censorship is an anathema. But people, between 1960 and 2012, people have had to fight to make that an anathema. It was the run of the mill every place else.
Well, this is Pacifica. This is WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and that is Bob Fass. And Bob Fass is one of my enduring heroes of radio broadcast.
Well, Robert, it's been terrific to talk to you. And I think we should do more of this stuff.
I'm amazed that we did this.
it's characteristic
of your frankness. I love this.
I was so chilled when I heard that report you did with Michael Ratner this afternoon. And when I heard Amy talking to him early in the morning, I thought this is something that has to be, you know, gotten out. That we are entering a time when we're going to have military trials of civilians. They have a whole different set of procedures in military trials. You know, they're not like civilian courts. They're not even like civilian courts. And civilian courts are bad enough.
Bob, I am here to celebrate the rare cherry on top of the cake and ice cream cone that is the beauty of your life, the very small part of it that can be encapsulated in film, in the premiere in New York, if I understand correctly, of Radio Unnameable at BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, on the 26th, Nespa?
7 o'clock. If you want a ticket, you'll have to go to the BAM website.
Mm-hmm.
To order it, and you can get tickets for the benefit of BAI as well.
Well, Bob, we think that you have more than earned this honor, this accolade. You are my hero. And everything I do with you is about learning, whether it's about admiration or confrontation. You are truly a genius of radio, and I love you, man.
Same here, Robert. Take care of yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bob Fass, BAM, on the 26th, here in New York at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they pick, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you. Of tender years, I know the fears that your elders grew by. And so please help them with your youth. They seek the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh,
Yeah, you cannot know. This is Earthwatch. I've been Robert Knight. Thanks to Michael Ratner, and thanks to Bob Fass. Go see the documentary about Bob Fass called Radio Unnameable at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And let me say that this is WBAI, Pacifica Radio in New York, and coming up in just a moment, through the graciousness of Jim Freund, is the inimitable Hour of the Wolf program. Hi, Jim.
I wanted to say one thing.
Yeah.
That you mentioned the Nina Hoffman book and all that. That's 80s. In the 70s, in science fiction, was the Illuminatus trilogy that pointed out in the very first Illuminatus book that the true information that was going out to everybody went through Radio Unnameable. Let me just, so we had it first.
Get out.
We did science fiction
you mean
people
like
knew
Robert
the
M. Todd Wilson and all them people?
The science fiction people knew the power of Fass before the mainstream writers of the 80s. That's all I wanted to say.
I knew Bob Fass when I before I was an egg, when I was a zygote or whatever you call that stuff. He's my hero. No.
Zygote, that's a planet I'm not familiar with. Well, Zygothians, I guess.
Well, you are wearing black. You're a little bit gothian.
Yeah, slightly goth. Slightly goth.
Come on, let's show people the magic of radio.
Oh,
as
we
do
geez.
The changing of the mics.
Oh.
The
changing of the mics.
This has been Earthwatch. Email me. I'm Robert Knight, RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. Thank you for having the courage to listen tonight. I love you all. See you next week.
Okay, now, you see, I need to start Hour of the Wolf, and I have a guest on recording and all that, but you can't do it without talking about Fass, because we are, all of us who do, okay, not only all of us who do free
I'm now on
radio,
the other mic.
But all of us that do any radio here at WBAI owe Fass this incredible debt of existence.
He's like white radio jazz. He's an improvisationalist of the first order.
I mean, the concept of how radio began, one can follow. It's not just the history of WBAI, although that is important enough. You cannot write the history of radio without writing about Fass. It's not possible. You cannot do it. I won't even say thorough. I mean, you know, bullet point, even on a bullet point level.
He is the ring pass knot of freeform radio.
Very much so. I mean, there was, which is, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, the whole premise, original premise behind Pacifica Radio. There are those people, I think a lot of people rewrite what it's about. They, oh, it's free speech radio. No.
No.
It's
the charter is very specific.
Yeah, that's correct. That is correct. Robert knows what he's talking about. Very few other people do. It is not about only listener sponsorship, because that was...
It's about creating an independent funding base.
It's about that, but it was also about that it was the first time ever that the person behind the microphone actually thought of the words that person was going to say. Everything else beforehand was scripted. And that was the second part of Lou Hill's grand vision. And actually on my website at ourwolf.com, I have a link to On the Theory of Listener-Sponsored Radio, written by Lou Hill. It's 1948, where Pacifica already exists, KPFA already exists. And he's written this monograph about what the KPFA pilot experiment is all about. It's a fascinating thing. And there you will read that what he's writing about is the fact that everything else on radio is scripted. The person behind the microphone is reading what somebody else has written. What makes Pacifica Radio different, what made Pacifica Radio different, aside from listener sponsorship, listener sponsorship was the way to allow this kind of radical radio to occur.
There is a a term that is used in regard to the regulation of media, in which the containers use the word responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, I'm dyslexic, Jim, and I misspell that word.
Mm-hmm.
And I separate it into the words responsibility. And the only way that a live terrestrial broadcast can have response
or extra ability broadcast, yes.
Well, no, that's mostly the FM because the AM gets damped out, but it's the FM which goes horizontally.
You're right.
I've studied this, 8 minutes to Pluto or whatever it is. 13 hours to Pluto, 8 minutes to the sun. And responsibility requires that the enactor on the microphone has the fealty to the institutional mission and the freedom to do jazz, to improvise on behalf of that mission at the moment of contact.
Exactly, exactly. Because what happened was that in the formation of Pacifica with Lou Hill came the idea that the person could think perhaps in advance, perhaps their own script, but that was the author. This is where FASS comes in.
Yeah.
FASS, in other words, let's say that Lou Hill introduced original classical music. FASS did jazz.
Yeah.
How's that?
Which
are
indigenous American classical music.
Bingo. Bingo. So we're going to consign FASS. He's not Stravinsky. He's Ellington.
I'm not an actor. I only play one on the radio.
There you go. There you go. So I think that's a fair metaphor. I really do. And I think that everything that the very fact of conversation, of segue, and all that goes on, especially on late night radio here in WBAI, all stems from FASS.
And I admire him because Bob had almost as much courage as the people who listened tonight.
Almost.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Robert. So tune in, by the way, not only go to the movie and all that, tune in tomorrow night at midnight. Thursday night
for
at midnight.
What?
Radio.
I forget.
I don't have a name.
The name of it.
I can't think of what it's called. It just doesn't occur to
me. I'll call Cabal.
That's it. The Cabal.
Thank you.
And speaking, this is not Cabal, this is broadcast.
This is Hour of the Wolf.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us tonight, by the Miracle of Science through recordings and various means. We will hear from Genevieve Valentine with a movie review, an interview, and a reading. Stay tuned.